Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Lin Shan Jiang. Today, I'm so delighted to have Professor Wang Ban with us here on air. Professor Wang, would you like to say hi to the listeners?
Hi. I'm very delighted to meet you on the web, on this online. This is the first time I had an interview in this fashion. So I express my gratitude and thanks to Lin Shan.
Thank you, Professor Wang. So first, let me introduce Professor Wang Ban. Professor Wang is the William Huss Endowed Chair Professor in Chinese Studies in the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures and Comparative Literature at Stanford University. His major publications include The Sublime Figure of History, Aesthetics and Politics in 20th Century China, Illuminations from the Past, History and Memory, and Narrative Perspective and Irony in Chinese and American Fiction. He edited Words and Their Stories, Essays on the Language of the Chinese Revolution, Chinese Visions of World Order. He co-edited Trauma and Cinema, The Image of China in the American Classroom, China and New Left Visions, and Debating Socialist Legacy in China. Today, we are discussing Professor Wang Ban's new monograph, China in the World, Culture, Politics, and World Vision, published by Duke University Press in 2022. We can see many close connections between this new book with the edited volume, Chinese Visions of the World Order, Tianxia, Culture, and World Politics, also published by Duke University Press in 2017. Besides, I can also see the link between your new book with your earlier books, The Sublime Figure of History and Illuminations from the Past. Professor Wang continues the discussion of Kantian and Hegelian philosophies, as well as the formation of modern China in relation to the world. Actually, all this reminds me of the first time I met Professor Wang when I was a master's student in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures at Tsinghua University in China in November 2015. Professor Yan Haiping invited Professor Wang to give two seminars in English. One is called Internationalism and World Literature, and the other is called National Culture and World Literature, as well as a campus-wide talk in Chinese entitled Rethinking World Literature and Internationalism in the Age of Global Capital. In Tsinghua University, I also took Professor Yan's graduate seminar about cosmopolitanism, and we traced the intellectual trajectory from Kant, Hegel, to Kang Youwei, Liang Qichao, and Mao Zedong. These were the starting points for me to think about connection between national literature and world literature, as well as the ideas of cosmopolitanism and internationalism in relation to China. This quarter at University of California, Santa Barbara, where I'm at right now, I'm also taking Professor Xu Hangping's graduate seminar entitled World Literature and Modern China. And we just discussed Professor Wang's new book in relation to the socialist film, Five Golden Flowers, which is also the text Professor Wang discussed in the fifth chapter, National Unity, Ethnicity, and Socialist Utopia in Five Golden Flowers. Some of the questions in this interview are also based on our class discussion. I really appreciate all the ideas generated in the discussion. Before we go into details of Professor Wang's book, I would like to offer the listeners an overview of it. In China in the World, Professor Wang traces the evolution of modern China from the late 19th century to the present, with a focus on tensions and connections between national formation and international outlooks. Professor Wang shows how Asian visions persist, even as China has adopted and revised the Western nation-state form. The concept of 天下, meaning all under heaven, has constantly been updated into modern outlooks that value unity, equality, and reciprocity as key to overcoming interstate conflict, social fragmentation, and ethnic divides. Instead of geopolitical dominance, China's worldviews stem as much from the age-old desire for world unity as from absorbing the Western ideas of the Enlightenment, humanism, and socialism. Examining political writings, literature, and film, Professor Wang presents a narrative of the country's pursuits of decolonization, national independence, notions of national form, socialist internationalism, alternative development, and solidarity with third world nations. Rather than national exceptionalism, Chinese worldviews aspire to a shared, integrated, and equal world. So now we will get started with our interview. The very first question, of course, is always this motivation of project. So I'm wondering, what is your motivation to do this project? And why do you consider 天下, all under heaven, as a significant discourse to discuss China in the world?
Thank you for the question. What motivated me to look into this subject is the phenomenon that we are familiar with now, is the rise of China in the last 2 or 3 decades. This phenomenon invited a lot of criticism and perceptions and even distortions. So I'm not very happy with some of the misperceptions, distortions. There is the idea that China, with its increased power in the world, poses a threat to the world order. Some say that it will bring beneficial, positive changes to the world. Some say that China is driven by nationalism and is bent on expanding its self-serving agenda around the world. And some Chinese thinkers also said that China has broken with its ancient and socialist past, right? 告别革命, getting on track with capitalist globalization, right? So I take issues with these distortions. I contend in the book that China has indeed long had an ambition to be a part of the world. Early thinkers recognized the importance of joining the modern world, which is composed of nation states, right? But these thinkers wanted to go beyond this very narrow framework, a world composed of nation states, because the current nation state system does not make for a peaceful world we know, right? It's very conflicted, polarized, it's uneven structure of power, dominant power and subordinated nations. So that sort of a status quo of modern nation state runs contrary to the idea of what a world is supposed to be. The inherited idea of 天下 from the ancient classics and sources and the education. Idea of 天下 projects a world of coexistence, economic exchange, as we see in the ancient Silk Road program, and also a shared, a common values. So Chinese thinkers always has 天下 in the back of their mind. It's almost like an unconscious in the back of their mind. When they attempt to enter the world of nation states. So 天下 has been a submerged and obscured idea because of the China's drive to enter the world of nation state. Yet it also in the back sort of drive them to go beyond the nation state. And this idea resurfaces at many points in modern Chinese history in the form of nationalism, in the form of internationalism, in the form of cosmopolitanism and third world relationship.
Yeah, now that you mentioned all these connections between all these terms, I think we can start from the beginning of first few chapters, which is the relationship between 天下, all under heaven, and 大同, great unity. These two ideas are very ancient in all kinds of ways. So what's the relationship between them? And also in your first few chapters, you discuss a lot of very important intellectuals in the modern China, such as Kang Youwei, Liang Qichao, and Sun Zhongshan. So how do they adopt and renovate these ideas into the so-called liberal cosmopolitanism?
So 天下 and 大同 are exchangeable in some ways, but still, I think that the distinction is still very important from the question. 天下 is all under heaven, right? It is distinct from another concept, empire. We still talk about empire as a administrative structure, right? Bureaucratic administrative structure. But 天下 refers to a regime of value and culture, as well as a social economic process. People should have access to a social economic process. They can till the land, they can do their own thing, right? 天下 would allow for that to happen. But 大同 points to a vision of unitary and shared or shareable ideas and sensibility that allow people to coexist and participate in a peaceful exchange. So it's a slightly different, higher vision than 天下, I think, 大同, because it's basically on the unitary. Unitary here should not be understood as a uniform or homogeneity, right? The same, right? It's not the same. Rather, it's an idea that emphasizes the unitariness, right? Some kind of unity within differences. You still keep the differences. In Chinese, it said 求同存异, right? You have the common ground, yet you still keep preserve your differences. And this is actually applied very well to the chapter you mentioned, Golden Flowers mentioned, because there's a national unity within ethnic diversity. Ethnic groups still keep their own culture, even though their culture is elevated into a national culture, right? So you can see the dialectic between the differences and unity. So it's 求同存异 is really characterizes 大同 idea. It is an antidote to the divisiveness and tribalism and military conflict that characterized the modern nation state system. 大同 is an idea that posited as a antidote, as a critique of this very conflicted, warlike system of nation state. So always at each other's throat, right? It's a Darwinian struggle for existence, that sort of thing. Now, Liang Qichao has thought about this idea of cosmopolitan state. It means the combination of the nation state form he borrows from Western nation state. And he endows the Western nation state form with the ability to relate to other people, other states, to relate and cooperate with other states in building and managing a more friendly and a shared world order. Sun Zhongshan has the similar idea. We know that Sun Yat-sen, all right, was a very strong nationalist, yet as a nationalist, he must have some kind of a reservation about cosmopolitanism, right? He actually said that cosmopolitanism was premature for China because China was a colonized nation. We are not in a position to promote cosmopolitanism when we are subjugated nation, he said. So it's an illusion. It's too early to promote cosmopolitanism. But Sun Yat-sen still expected China to take on cosmopolitanism or cosmopolitan responsibility when the time is right. Now, what is the time? When the time comes when China becomes stronger, right, and play a role in the world arena. So he said that we must achieve the status of equality and freedom with other nations before we promote cosmopolitanism. It still have the nation state idea and cosmopolitanism as a following it, right? So it's not just simply a nation self-serving nation state, selfish nation state. Sun Yat-sen's remark captures the dialectic interplay between national discourse and cosmopolitan aspiration. Mao has also similar idea. Mao Zedong, he links communism to Da Tong at many points, right? He claimed that, I quote here, only China's independence and liberation will make it possible to participate in internationalism, which means the communism, the world communism. So to be involved and to be a player in creating a unitary world order, a country has become independent and powerful nation, okay? So that's the idea. So these ideas are not part of liberal cosmopolitanism. In the introduction, and also in Liang Qichao chapter, I talk about the distinction between liberal cosmopolitanism and distinction between liberal cosmopolitanism and socialist internationalism. Now, liberal cosmopolitanism believes that trade, commerce, and worldwide capitalist circuit, right, the flow of capital and expansion market will facilitate global connectivity and make the world a civil place, very civil, and a public place or a marketplace or a fair, right? Sounds like a sort of a Tianxia idea, because people come together to exchange ideas and goods. So that's a very good idea. But the history of 20th century proved that to be an illusion. Why? Why is illusion? Revolutionary thinkers like Mao Zedong, even Sun Yat-sen and Zhou Libo, they think like Sun Zhongshan. They think in the way that Sun Zhongshan thinks. They see clearly that the capitalist world order is dominated by an unequal, even predatory structure. The structure is colonialism and imperialism. And this structure makes the world a very miserable place for the wretched of Earth, the majority of the world's population, actually. For the subalterns, it's a hell of a place for subalterns. These revolutionary thinkers promote alliance and solidarity among the oppressed and colonized nation. This is a world-making project, just as the capitalism is a world-making project, but it's two different kind of world-making project. Socialist international rests on the national independence and decolonization movements. Right, this is the one part of socialist internationalism. And the other part is the alliance and mutual support among the colonized and independence-seeking nations. So you have two parts. You need to have a nation first, and then you have a support and solidarity between nations. And this is it runs through the later Third World Project, and it still persists in the current discussion of the potential of social movements in the global South, right? Because we still live in a world order that is very, very unequal, right? Economically, they're unequal.
Yeah, I think you touch your point. The next question that I'm going to ask it's the deviation from this kind of liberal cosmopolitanism and then building up the socialist internationalism, especially by Mao Zedong and then Zhou Libo, that you discussed a lot in chapter 3. But at the same time, I do have this question that I think it's very central, and I think it's always quite controversial. That is different kinds of world-making projects we're just talking about. And there's this tension between you want to find equality and equity, but at the same time, you always face different kinds of hierarchies and powers. And you were talking about this power of capital. But at the same time, we may have military power. I may recall a very classical film in the Chinese-speaking world, Zhang Yimou's hero, Yin Xiong, in 2002. This ending that finally military power reigns.
Yeah.
So how do you see that tension there?
Yeah, this is a very, very, very good question, because the Tianxia idea, as we noted earlier, is connected to the empire building. Empire is, by its nature, a hierarchical structure. It's about having a dominant power presiding over lesser power. So Tianxia idea proposes the equality, but the equality and the universal access to social economic benefits and resources. That's the Tianxia idea. Like in a sort of a ruling class's benevolent compassion for ren zheng, right? Ren zheng for common people. That's more Tianxia value, virtue, de. But the other side of Tianxia is a what might be called the legalist thinking, fa jia. Legal thinking think that to overcome the conflict, you need a bigger power to overcome, to prevail over the chaotic and anarchistic splitting, separated forces. In order to overcome the separate forces and bring them into the fold, you have to have sort of a unequal power relations. So this is the part of the contradiction within the Tianxia idea, and it's been running through all the discussion and practices in ancient China and modern China, right? Is Tianxia a equality, or Tianxia is another geopolitical domination? I discussed that in the edited volume, in the introduction in the edited volume, right? Because it's running together. Another interesting thing about this is that the hierarchy itself is not necessarily an oppressive thing. Not necessarily. Most of the time it's very oppressive, it's a dominating oppressive. But if you think of a hierarchy as a sort of more ideal family relationship, you need the hierarchy. Because you need to have the authority of the father, and you need to have the legitimacy of a ruler. In a village community, you need to have the authority of tradition or authority of the elders, right? In order to keep social function in a peaceful fashion. This is even true of democratic society. Even true democracy, you need to have the representative of the people. But representative is in the higher order of political structure. So that's why in a republican and democratic society, the leadership is still very important. But the leadership involves hierarchy. The leadership is really, and meritocracy, I mean the enlightened leadership, meritocracy. It needs the virtue, it needs the exemplary, the knowledge, right, and expertise to manage a democratic society, right? So that's why leadership is so important. Leadership involves hierarchy, actually. So I think the one way to soften the sting of hierarchy is to say, right, that hierarchy may be reciprocity. Maybe a reciprocal relationship, right? Of course, you have to obey if the leader's authority and policy is expression of people's idea, why don't you reject it, right? Because it's coming from top, right? So you think about the hierarchy as a symbiotic reciprocity between the leaders and the led, the leaders and the led. And I mean, in the family, it can be the father figure or maybe mother figure. Mother also has authority to lead the children in the right way, to cultivate the children in the right way, raise the children in the right way. Still, so you can soften that hierarchy. I would even go on to say that no hierarchy, no society, because the order is always, any kind of order always involves hierarchy. Otherwise, it's just chaotic. It's anarchy.
I actually feel anarchism is the thing that I pursue. But again, maybe that's another utopia. But yes, we can continue our questions. Our next question is actually coming to fourth and fifth chapters of this monograph that is about the Korean War films and the socialist films. So how do you see the relationship between politics and the aesthetics in your analysis of these two kinds of films?
Mm-hmm. Politics, we know, is commonly regarded as being about power relations and struggle. Aesthetics is about emotion, feeling, sensibility, and sometimes manifest in art and performance, right? But what we see in Chinese notion of politics in the films and is a kind of politics that's animated not by power dynamics, not by intriguing or some kind of a struggle, but by culture and spirit, emotion, and bodily mobilization of bodily energy. Politics, in this sense, is driven by an aesthetic experience, meaning emotional, sensuous, vibrantly sensuous, and spiritual experience. So in Heroic Sons and Daughters, Yin Xiong Erni, you'll find that the art and performance inspires some kind of spirit, fighting spirit, right? And the spirit is supposed to translate into military power, like power of battle, fighting energy and power. It's a soldier's body and a sort of a potential expanded into, it's weaponized, you might say, it's weaponized, right? This constitutes what I call the politics of spirit, or what the scholar call it Mao's military romanticism. It's like a soldier's power is greater than weapons, is superior to weapons.
If I may add to that, I think in these two chapters, you also discuss a lot about the relationship between ethnicity, nation, and class. Would you like to elaborate on that as well?
Mm-hmm. The category of class comes up because it is a way to transcend the ethnic divide that we find in a lot of criticism of Chinese Han perspective. A lot of people say there's a Han perspective, Han people from the cultural center, right, are looking down upon ethnic groups as exotic, right, as other, right, and a male gaze looking at women as very exotic, other, as subordinated to the male gaze, that sort of thing. This kind of perspective is premised upon ethnic sort of a hierarchy, right? Han is on the top of hierarchy. So ethnic people group like Baizhu is in the lower level of the hierarchy. But the introduction of the class and socialism is meant to say that actually people of different ethnicities may come together as a class that liberate themselves from the earlier structure of exploitation and domination, maybe by the tribal leaders, right, by their local leaders. And they try to create a condition to develop their social, political, a society that allows them to prosper, to achieve the fruits of social economic development. So this basically is a liberated people. If you use class, liberated from actually ethnic, the kind of control that is based on ethnic culture. So ethnicity itself is not always like positive thing, because it's related to some kind of a pre-modern tribal kind of structure. It's not necessary. When you say ethnic identity, sometimes people say, oh, that's good, because it asserts the identity of the people. Oh, okay, that's okay. If the identity is for the benefits of the whole group. But the ethnic identity, is ethnic divide in the socialist landscape may not be for the benefits of the common ethnic people, because it's really marked the identity of the ruling class. Category of class become very, very useful to transcend the traditionally entrenched ethnic cultural boundaries, right, and the political structure, and bring different kind of people into a common ground. That is the working for the prosperity of a common society, right? Everybody wins, supposedly, that everybody wins in the situation. You can see that the people are brought out of their own ethnic background into a market fair, right? You can see the marketplace, everybody comes in, and if you enjoy the exchange of goods, arts and performance and golden flowers, right?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I do think there's a very interesting tension and also dynamic between ethnicity and class, as what you just described, especially in this socialist film, Five Golden Flowers. And I definitely recommend everyone to watch it. Now let's come to your sixth chapter about global Maoism. So what is global Maoism and how does it play out in cultural productions and social developments? How do depoliticization and repoliticization connect to a discussion of the third world?
I present Maoism in terms of self-reliance, Zhili Gongsheng, because China was isolated, not by itself, by the so-called world community, right? Basically, the superpowers isolated China. But Maoism is also refers to the pursuit of alternative social economic development. It's a reliance on the mobilized people, including the third world people. It is a faith in the people's power against bureaucratic and technocratic path of modernity. So there is idea of the modernity as a technocratic and engineering project. It's just a scientific and technology program, an administrative program to be managed by experts, scientists, and bureaucrats who know better than people. A good image to show Maoism at work is the barefoot doctor. Barefoot doctor in the film, Chun Miao, is a very good example, concrete example of Maoism as a grassroots movements to challenge the technocratic, bureaucratic agenda of modernity. the technocratic bureaucratic agenda of modernity is also a part of the co-world vision of the world order. The world order should follow, I mean, according to that kind of Cold War view of world, the world was progress on the science and technology, on the expert and technocratic elites, not on the working class people. So the Bedford Doctor present a belief in the people's own initiatives. They started this practice on their own. It's a radical new thing, 新生事物, right? Against monopoly of experts, doctors, and bureaucrats to run their own medical clinics, medical care, and treatment. Bedford Doctor works against the inequality between the powerful and powerless, inequality between the city and the countryside. Now, this challenge of social power is a social and grassroots power against technocratic elitism is a threat, is really a narrative, very important narrative that has a worldwide resonance, It's about really about searching for alternative kind of a modernization. This idea lies at the heart of the third world movement. A lot of people in the Third World Movement also started this kind of practice. Bedford Doctor and other kind of land reform movements, people would take control of their own destiny and take control of their own life. And it relates to the contemporary movements of the Global South. The Global South will not be dependent on global capital. They will have their own society and economic model, right? That's just alternative, right? Now, about depoliticization, the whole domination of technocratic and administrative regime, right? This is the key that they say, modernization narrative said, this is the key to sort of normal universal modernization. That is already a sign of depoliticization. Why? Because it has emphasis on the administrative regime. The whole drive to modernize depends on the administrative regime, depends on the state, experts, bureaucrats, right? This is not a political regime. It's not a political regime. By political, I mean that political is really about mobilize the social power to build their own community and politics, that's political. But the modernization technocratic model says no to that because people don't have power, people just tools, objects. So this kind of a vision, technocratic vision, treats the population and individual as objects of administration and control, right? So people have no voice. The people are not participants in the political process. They are not citizens. They're just objects and tools. They don't have a voice in the political process. And they have no part to play in decision-making. The decisions that affect their own lives. They have no part of it, right? It's all controlled by the higher order elites, right? Who supposedly know better. That is a depoliticization. In terms of depoliticized teaching of China, right, in American classroom, we can also see that there is a turning away from the political mobilization of people in building their own community and politics. So you think of China simply as an object. That has no history, right? People it's just an economic project. The sort of depoliticization in the American classroom in teaching actually means the inability and refusal to treat a country with a sovereign power to build and carve out its own path of history, of its own culture and political formation. So he's not just as a person, he's not a server. intelligent person. The country is not intelligent subject doing its own thing. It's just simply a under my gaze, right? It's there. China is there as far as it fits into, for my understanding, for all student understanding, China is to be treated in terms of how that country fits into a established pattern of world capitalism, right? How they fit into the world capitalism. That's China. And as a personal attitude, the depoliticization attitude treat China as a means to satisfy my preference and my desire, right? China is a workplace. China is a exotic. So in a very broad framework that I quote from Alistair MacIntyre, the depoliticized stance treats other as a means, not as an end. You treat people as only a means to something, not as an end. Treat people as end means people have own subjectivity, right? Have their own participation, have their own say in mapping out their own destiny and process. And this is not there. Very often, it's a vacuum in the students' understanding of China. China is a picture, it's an image, right? Very superficial. If you think about the once upon a time in China, Shanghai Jishi, that I discuss in the depoliticization chapter, you can see that the liberation of Shanghai is the event that is narrated by the film. But ironically, the political event of liberating Shanghai, Shanghai Jiefang, was taken away. Like basically, it's stripped of its political content. So the liberation of Shanghai is not a political event, a political and revolutionary event, but an economic and managerial event. It suggests that this capitalist daughter, right, single-handedly bring Shanghai from the woods, from trouble, right, from the economic and social political trouble, right, because she's a very wise capitalist person, and it sowed the seeds of capitalism. It means that the whole film suggests that capitalism liberates Shanghai, and Shanghai's liberation is a social economic event, not a political event. Political event means that it's people who are building their own nation, right, politically. Now, what's a political? Political means polis. Polis means building a political community, right, by the society and the people. It's not just simply the leaders. Leaders can only do so much. Without the mass of people, you cannot build a nation. But here in the capitalist line of narrative, Shanghai is a liberation of Shanghai is a capitalist event, how Shanghai fit into global capitalism, basically. So to repoliticize, as the question asked, to repoliticize, we have to bring the context, political context, that means a lot of history, into our discussion of Chinese images. In Balzac and Little Chinese Seamstress, that another films, that is also deprived, is sort of a empty out and the political contents. They just read Balzac, right? As Balzac is a godsend, is a universal Western culture, but they don't read Lu Xun. They don't know that Balzac is a very important inspiration for Zhou to jumpstart some kind of political idea of realism.
If I may follow up with that question of depoliticization and repoliticization, you actually proposed a lot of other ideas about changing the situation. Do you want to elaborate more on that point as well?
In the last chapter, I basically just restate the element of culture in mobilizing political forces. So it still runs the same kind of thesis that says the political needs to be animated, maybe driven by sort of cultural experience and cultural mobilization and spiritual sort of elevation. It's a very, very Confucian idea. Morality takes the lead of political power struggle. Morality and culture takes the lead. But I also try to distinguish sort of a culturally animated, culturally driven idea of politics from the politics as a real naked political struggle. That's another notion of hegemony, right? 霸权, right? There's two kinds of hegemony. One is dominant power. The other is leadership, right? It's from Gramsci's idea. It's got leadership, meaning you have to win the heart and mind of the population. You need to have a legitimacy. Legitimacy is culture. It's culture. That's how you mobilize people. That's how you jumpstart political movements.
Now that we come to the very end of the whole book, you actually end the book with a question. So I quote, "Will China rule the world or bring harmony to it?" End of quote. So what is your vision or what is your ideal utopia? So whom do you want to address this question to?
My sense is that China will continue to try in the face of all challenges and attack. They try to bring a image of harmony, Da Tong, into the world. Even though they have not succeeded, the Chinese leaders and Chinese intellectuals have been trying to bring this idea into the world. So Mao actually said in the 70s, I quote him in the last paragraph, I think, that China should never become a hegemony. Hegemony in the bad sense, meaning a dominant power, right? I think that point still holds. Now, my vision of utopia is that I'm not sure. I'm not sure about the likelihood of a realized utopia. Utopia is just a vision, right? Just a vision. And if we think about a realized vision, maybe we are not doing a good service. I cannot predict, and I should not predict, right? What kind of vision will be realized? What kind of blueprint will come into being, right? That's not what I want to say, right? I think nobody can say that. But what I learned from my own research and my look at history is that from all these past surveys, examination, is that just simply harboring the dream of a Da Tong dreams or Tianxia dream itself is important, right? Harboring this dream is very important. Dreaming the dream is very important. It's very precious and significant because it makes it less likely that China is going to be another imperial power to dominate the world. Because you have this idea that China is obligated to play a reconciliatory, a friendly part, right, in the world, right? This is what long history has been about, right? If you remember that dream, you will come to the world not as a elephant in the room, right, just smashing everything. You come to the room as a friendly force, factors, right? To make friends, to ensure that we coexist in a sort of more friendly way, to have a win-win situation in economic and social development, that's trade and commerce, right? As we imagine back in the past, right? There's a trade route. Here we have one belt, one road. That actually benefits a lot of local areas, as well as, of course, China. But it's still, I would say, it's not a exploitative situation. I doubt if it is exploitative situation. I think keeping that dream alive itself just very, very important and very precious as we are confronted with the world is going down to the disintegration. Right, is disintegrate into a warring parties, conflicted and polarized and divisive.
If I may answer the second half of the question. I think you are asking this question to everyone who is reading your book. And I think that's very important to always keep in mind and keep thinking.
Who do I address my thesis to? Of course, the people who have doubt about China's intention, right? People who think China is an elephant in a room, going to smash everything. I would just tell them that you just look Chinese history. China actually has not done that much smashing of the things in the room. And then also the intellectuals have always thought about China as a friendly factors, right, in the world. And the socialism also also conceive of China as a aligning with the oppressed, fighting against the hegemonic power, not to conquer the world, but fighting against hegemonic power.
Great. So now that we have finished the discussion of this particular book, I'm wondering about your next book project. So what's your next book project?
I've just actually completed the book manuscript.
Oh, wow.
It's about the current China in the World is a book that was basically done about 2 years ago, right? It's copy edited it's early last year. During the COVID, I have plenty of time to revise and rewrite and expand some articles that I wrote during the courses I taught in the last 5 years, 5 to 6 years. The courses are about ecology. So the book is about, it's about ecology, technology, and labor. I argue that the root cause of ecological crisis is political and social economic system, not our attitude about nature. It's not about our attitude towards nature. It's about its political system. It's the system. It's a capitalist system, overproduction, consumption, over extraction of natural resources. Now, that's the system that is at fault, and the system that dominates nature and human beings. That's the problem. So rather than the ethical and metaphysical matter of thinking about nature, ecological philosophy urges us to think about nature in the way we think like a mountain, to think like the trees, right? That's the ethical idea. It does not touch the political issue of the system. I think it's a political issue. It's not just simply an ethical issue. So I approach ecological crisis as a historical product of capitalist modernity. So still follow my earlier thesis, it's still a critique of capitalist modernity as the culprit of ecological crisis. So I critique capitalist economic agenda, its production, its consumption, and its technocratic, techno-scientific myth of progress, of infinite development, or a scientific triumphalism and utopia. I also look at Chinese film, literature of the old days, the socialist era, some of them. Yeah, I investigate politics and technology and labor process and human engagement with nature. And I apply Frankfurt School critical theory and what you might call the critical ecology. There's been a discovery of a sort of ecological implication of critical theory in Walter Benjamin, Adorno, and many other people. So there's eco-critical critique of capitalist system in Frankfurt School. There's another school that I borrowed, that's the they call it eco-socialism, right? Eco-socialism, the main figure in this eco-socialism is John Foster, all right? He wrote many books about how a different kind of system of production, of engagement with nature will help solve at least deal with the crisis in the relationship between human production and nature. So the book continues my critique of technocratic path of modernity, which is very, very, has already brought about ecological crisis and environmental troubles, right? And I still try to posit a different alternative model of production of nature and human society.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to your new book, and it's coming out. So, wow, so excited to hear that. And again, thank you so much for accepting this interview from New Books Network and coming to New Books Network. And I wish I can keep this a very thought-provoking discussion with you in the near future. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too, for inviting me to chat about my book in such a wonderful platform. It makes me think more clearly about my own idea. And I hoped when the ecology book comes out, we can have another online chat.
Yeah, definitely. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much.